Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by Amy Fried and Doug Harris, who are the authors of a new book, At War with Government, How Conservatives Weaponized Distrust from Goldwater to Trump. This was published in 2021 by Columbia University Press, and it is both a historical and a meta-analysis of how distrust has been employed, used strategically, particularly by the Republicans, but not exclusively. And I'm going to ask Amy and Doug to tell us a little bit about that as we talk about their excellent new book. First, I'd like to welcome them to the New Books Network and to ask them to tell me a little bit about themselves and how you came to this project together. Hi, Amy. Hi, Doug.
Well, hi, Lily. Amy here. And really, the main story is that Doug and I overlapped for a year when we were both at Colgate University before we both left and went other places, made careers other places. And we originally, many years ago, wrote a paper for a conference at University of Nebraska that was focused on trust and distrust in government. Which that paper ended up in an edited volume. And then many years later, we revisited it for a paper in the forum about the Tea Party and distrust. And then Doug quite brilliantly said to me, gee, maybe this should be a book. And I said, that is just the best idea. So then we went really to work on it. And, started pulling in lots of other research and doing more archival trips. And I'll let Doug speak for himself in terms of his own background, but my interest has, I've written a lot of different things. I've kind of varied a bit, but I consider my main focus to be on the history and political uses of public opinion. So it came really out of that interest, and also a little bit of an interest in health policy. But we have somewhat varied interests, really.
Doug?
Yeah, I think that was an important part of the early collaboration, which was Amy was focused on public opinion and the politics of public opinion. And I was focused on congressional rhetoric and the use of media by congressional leaders. At the time, it was Newt Gingrich. And this was really one of those places where Amy's interests and my interests overlapped, and we really saw that there was some connect between what she was studying in the politics of public opinion and what I was studying. And then, you know, I think that early paper that we wrote about the Gingrich Revolution and the cultivation of distrust in government during that time was in some ways sort of a cautionary tale. I think the tone of that first piece was, if we continue down this road, this could be really bad. And one of the reasons that we continued in this research was that the rhetoric of American politics did continue down this road, from the Tea Party to Trump, the anti-government rhetoric and the anti-government strategy within conservative circles and the National Republican Party became more vehement and ultimately more dangerous.
And I know that you say this, I think, in the acknowledgments, that you had sort of hoped that this book wouldn't need to be written. But it sounds to me like it needed to be written. And given, you know, my reading of it, there's a lot in it that you sort of unearth and connect in terms of understanding this role of rhetoric from politicians in particular. And in the last 50 years, politicians on the right, and a sort of embedded strain of distrust in government that has always been with us. So I'd like to ask you, since this is also sort of how you start out the book, with at least giving a little bit of an overview of that historical strain that is present in the United States.
Sure. I'll take that. I think that one of the things that when we teach American politics, we realize is that the concerns about the large state as a threat to individual freedom, the concerns about centralization of power and the distance from the center of government to throughout the country more generally, has always been a concern in American national politics, and that concern continues to be revisited, that there is this cultural strain of suspicion of government that predates the American founding and resurges, like most cultural strains in American politics resurge at various points. And one way to look at the trajectory of American political development is to think of it as a perpetual struggle between centralizers and decentralizers, and those that seek to use the state seek to build and cultivate trust in government and in state capacity and state effectiveness, and those that seek to undermine those efforts have distrust as a ready weapon, because it is built into, I think, the American fabric of political thought.
And, you know, I guess I would add to that, this, you know, all of that is absolutely so, that, like, we are seeing a trajectory of, even though these things wax and wane in the decades that we're covering, there's a movement from what could be called maybe more reasonable skepticism. I mean, skepticism towards government is perfectly appropriate. It's in fact, I would say, a democratic virtue to, you know, want to hold those in power accountable. So a movement from skepticism to really intense distrust to what we've seen really recently, which is this delegitimization of government, whether that's, you know, with the elections seen, you know, really strongly in the January 6th insurrection, or when it comes to even things like public health officials and what they have to say with some of the, you know, responses to vaccines and other public health officials. And with all that makes it, you know, just a move away from, like, we want to govern, but do it with smaller government, to being almost, you know, completely uninterested in governing, just really wanting to stop things, you know, really to just say, no, let's not do anything. So, like, when we were working on the Reagan chapter, obviously Reagan was seen as, you know, a very strong father of modern conservatism. On the other hand, he was a governor of California before he was president. And even as president, he did not, you know, try to dismantle the state or use the same, you know, or use the same sign, really, really negative language towards opponents that you start to see later on, from really from Gingrich on.
And so in talking about this idea of distrust in government, as you say, there's all this idea of healthy skepticism and paying attention to what our elected representatives are doing, making sure that they're not corrupt. That's one thing. But this sort of turn to distrust, for a long time, I was looking at this as a kind of anger that's also directed at the government. And you talk about this a bit in the book as well, that there's a combustion that happens with regard to the distrust and the anger. Can you sort of tease out and define a little bit what we're talking about with regard to this idea of distrust, and how it's sort of woven now into this polarized sort of dynamic?
Okay, I'll take a little bit of an effort at this, and I'm sure Doug will jump in as well. But I mean, really what we're talking about is how distrust is weaponized. That's the term that we use. It's part of our subtitle, and we introduce it very early on. So the sort of maybe like baseline or natural distrust, or, you know, certainly valid levels of distrust are going to be out there. But there's a certain cultivation and encouragement of it so that it can be used as a political weapon. And we, you know, analytically draw that out in four different ways, running through all the different case studies. So distrust being used to try to win elections, to try to build and maintain political organizations, to wage policy battles, and then also in intra-institutional struggles. So distrust is being cultivated and encouraged in those ways. Now that doesn't mean that it's just simply created out of whole cloth by elites, even though our emphasis is on elites and what leaders are doing, because, you know, certainly there's some unhappiness in the public that's out there. But we used a metaphor, and the very first thing that we wrote on distrust that I think was a wonderful metaphor, which was a bullfighter. We had this little Hemingway epigraph, where Hemingway was talking about a bullfighter waving the red cape. And but the problem with that, you know, you wave the red cape to excite the bull, to get the bull that already has this sort of unruly temperament to charge. But then it can also get turned on them. So one of the things that we say is that this distrust and what comes out of cultivating it and weaponizing it can sometimes turn against those who try to, you know, encourage it or have it go in directions they're not really happy with. And, you know, for example, certain members of the Republican establishment who themselves became, you know, the subject or well, rather the object of that lost office or just were not particularly happy with the way that it went. So, you know, we're not saying that there's not real distrust out there in the public, but it's there's a relationship between public distrust and then it being cultivated and weaponized, focused in all these various ways.
Doug, would you like to add to that?
Sure. I think this is one of the places where Amy's understanding of the politics of public opinion really feeds into this, because with the increased use of polling and focus group technologies, the Republicans were able to identify distrust already existing in public opinion, and then figure out, as Frank Luntz would say, words that work, and as Newt Gingrich would try to teach Republicans, the words that would really resonate with an angry public. And then they would use those terms and as a way of ginning up that public anti-government sentiment, only to achieve those benefits that Amy outlined, but then they're apt to lose control of it. So then they get this public very angry, and the public becomes very anti-government, anti-establishment, and then that gets revisited on some of these leaders. So you could see the careers of Eric Cantor or Paul Ryan, where they had ginned up some of that anti-government, anti-Washington sentiment. Then it consumes them, and one wonders if this is Kevin McCarthy's future. One wonders if this is the future of a number of Republicans who have used that anti-government sentiment and really gotten the public good and angry at Washington. How much of that is going to be revisited on them? Because I think the combustibility of it is once you start that fire, it's really hard to put it out.
And so the aim of the book and the thesis of the book also is that conservatives weaponized it. So this is not each side did the same thing, and they're both using distrust in government, or they're both using sort of incendiary rhetoric in the same ways, but that there's a narrative that you're sort of tracking, as you note, from Goldwater forward. And so it's not the immediate post-war period, but it's kind of after the Eisenhower administration, that starts to make use of these kind of rhetorical moves to kind of readjust the Republican Party. This is also when we're starting to see the South, what's going on in the South, and of course the famous Southern strategy. So can you talk also about why the Republican Party has kind of made more use of this than the Democratic Party in the last 50 years?
Yeah, I think that part of what is at work here is for a variety of reasons, the state has become the principal tool of Democrats, especially the domestic policy state has become the principal tool of Democrats, and where the Democratic ideology and policy program has relied on the state, this casts the Republicans as the anti-state party. And I think we're pretty careful at the beginning of the book to identify a couple of instances in the past where left-leaning organizations and left-leaning political leaders would similarly seek to use distrust, that this is not inherently a politics associated with conservatives as opposed to liberals or progressives. But it is at this particular point in time, the strategy fits better with the Republicans' aims and ideology than with the Democrats. But, you know, I mean, you said at the beginning that one of the things that we had noted in our introduction to the book was that we wish this book hadn't been written. And I think part of that comes from a naivete I have about politics, which is I take people at their word and I let them disappoint me. I grew up in 1980s America, sort of hearing that the left movements of the 1960s were undoing society and breeding distrust in a political system. And then I saw that strategy just sort of taken from the left and employed by the right. And a lot of the disintegration that we're seeing right now in American society is attributable to this political rhetoric and to this political strategy. And I think one of the negative takeaways from our book, one of the sad conclusions, is that this is a strategy that does help conservatives build organizations, win elections, win institutional battles, and beat back policies that they don't like. This is a strategy that's likely to stick around, despite the fact that it does do some pretty serious damage to American government and American society.
Yeah, and I agree with all of that. And, you know, just sort of the parties are different point, you know, I'd point to, you know, how this fits with, you know, what's been called asymmetric polarization by Norm Ornstein and Thomas Mann, and various constitutional law scholars talking about constitutional hardball. That gets that means, you know, there are differences in how the parties operate, and Republicans are more likely to engage in and excuse constitutional hardball. There's the with the polarization, it is asymmetric, so there's more extreme and anti-democratic attitudes among Republicans. We're certainly seeing that, you know, after the book was written in the polling about January 6th, for example, and even about the acceptability of violence as a tactic. And I do think it has to do with something that we spoke about very briefly, which is the shift to, in terms of regional bases to the party, so that the Republican Party, it's obviously not just powerful in the South, but it's powerfully affected by the South. And so, you know, you have all kinds of racialized messages. You have with Reagan and beyond, the rise of the religious right and the Republican Party. So all these different cultural kinds of issues. You have, you know, in the Goldwater Age, other conspiracy theories, the paranoid style, John Birch Society. But as part of those, a part of that Southern element, certain attitudes about gender, more traditional values, you might say, anti-feminist attitudes. And so, you know, the part of this, of what's going on, is this real pushback against modernity in a way, you know, a more pushback against a more multicultural, equal kind of vision of society, and seeing that is extremely dangerous. And I wouldn't say we talk about that a lot in the book, but I think there are bits and pieces here and there that, you know, that's part of what we're talking about, you know, and it is part of what is going on with why is it the Republican Party that's doing this and not the Democratic Party.
And I wanted to ask you, because you set this up in a really interesting way, because you talk about the sort of shifts, as you just noted, Amy, with regard to regionalism or the regional bases of the parties, and that you note in the book that this sort of line and rhetoric of distrust united different aspects of the Republican Party to kind of build the organization. And as you note, there are these four different components that are used that make use of this distrust. Can you talk about what those planks are, or parts of the Republican Party that were sort of woven together in this kind of tapestry of distrust? For too much of an extended metaphor there.
No, it's a great question. I actually want to toss it over to Doug, because he was, I think people can't necessarily tell what I wrote and what he wrote, but he kind of originally, as I know, drafted this discussion about the Reagan coalition and the different parts that were brought together. So I think he should be the one to explain it.
Sure. I always think of the metaphor that the modern Republican Party is this stool, and there are these three legs: the social conservatives, the economic conservatives, the foreign policy conservatives. And one of the real tricks of leading a multifaceted political coalition, which any party coalition is and must be, is how do you convince the members of the coalition that they have something in common? Part of the argument that we make in the book is that distrust is not just a strategy, but it's the principal strategy, in part because to lean too heavily on social issues leads to a fracturing of the coalition, because some of the economic conservatives, some of the libertarians, don't believe in the large state you need to impose what Republicans might call moral order. And at the same time, it scares off independent voters that you might need to get yourself over the top to win a congressional majority or to win the presidency. But it's that strategy of suspicion in the state and anti-government rhetoric that brings the social conservatives in because they don't like Washington telling them what to do, and they don't like these distant elites telling them what to do. The economic conservatives want lower taxes and lower regulation. So as a result, and some independents can buy into that because there is this long cultural strain of anti-state suspicion. And as a result, this is the strategy that works without scaring off the independents that you need. And the Republicans keep returning to it. And one of the things that I really like about the evidence we were able to put in the book is that this isn't just merely conjecture. We find some of the planning memos where the Republicans are actually saying, this is exactly why we're doing this. And they're using public opinion polls, and they're using their focus groups to find out which of these strategies are going to help them maintain unity within the coalition and bring in enough independents to put them over the top for the 94 election, or to put them over the top when they're trying to push back against Barack Obama and throughout. This is the strategy to which they repeatedly return.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like some of the memos surrounding the rise of Newt Gingrich, you know, him becoming speaker, the whole contract with America, the lead up to that. We have all these, you know, they're avoiding being strong, making anything about social conservative things. Nothing in the contract with America is a social conservative, you know, plank in a very overt kind of way, you know. And so, you know, that it's sort of like, let's not frighten off certain people by going heavy on this as a national agenda. But, you know, certainly it was, the underlying idea was that the national government, or at least, you know, the Congress plus Clinton were corrupt. And that you can't trust the government. And it showed up with the healthcare, you know, fight against Clinton's healthcare as well.
And so if we're looking at this sort of coalition that grows up in the post-war period, that also is the result of changes with regard to policies that the Democrats are advocating for, like the Great Society and, of course, the Civil Rights acts that transpired during the Johnson administration. You also sort of thread throughout this book the role that race plays with regard to sort of how you can weaponize distrust in government. Can you explain a bit about how the constancy of this issue in the United States is something that can be built into this question of distrust in government?
Well, a lot of it comes down to, you know, how policies get associated with race, and then also, you know, whether the beneficiaries are seen as deserving. You know, there's obviously a long literature about that. But it can be, you know, returned to again and again. You know, a lot of the associations that people have with Social Security is not as a, you know, a policy involving race and desert, you know, that deservingness is not really an issue. Everyone is seen as deserving as a universal program, although there's a whole history of Social Security in which, you know, a lot of Black people did not have access to Social Security for a while. Well, certain other policies, you know, there's these various racial tropes from Reagan's welfare queen on. You know, one of the policy areas we looked at, or policy fights we looked at, was over the crime bill, the Clinton crime bill, which, you know, if you talk to most people today, they think of it as overly punitive, and they criticize it for promoting racially disparate sentencing outcomes. But really, at the time, Republicans attacked it in these racialized ways as being, sort of too liberal. And that, you know, there was this big, there were all of these programs in it that that were supposed to be prevention programs, community-based activities. One of them was this, what was commonly known at the time as midnight basketball. And there were all of these racialized attacks on it. And then, you know, anybody who would maybe go and play basketball was presented in this kind of frightening way. If you're going to play basketball in Chicago somewhere, then, you know, you're this scary guy with, you know, in a kind of racialized way. So it keeps happening because it is obviously effective to some extent. They certainly think it's effective. But, you know, I mean, I don't think you can understand American politics really at any time without taking account of race. It's just such a important part of our history and our political development. I mean, there are other things obviously that are important at different points, but it's so embedded. You know, when Republicans were trying to take some more power in southern states as part of the Southern strategy, that obviously was related to the civil rights movement and the voting rights movements, where that's how they, you know, you run against that. You also bring up the social welfare kinds of policies and you know, move the white voters to the Republican Party. And I would think most people who, you know, probably every political scientist who studies American politics knows this, but the last time a Democratic presidential candidate won the white vote was 1964, you know, after that, no. So, it, you know, it clearly has had impacts.
And I'll add that, you know, to go back to our original arguments from early in the book, America has always had this deep suspicion toward the state, but it's been especially so in the South. And that's always been true. And for a while, that's what made the Democratic Party, which had its base in the South, that's what made the Democratic Party the anti-state party for so long. And where those sentiments were strongest, it was also the case that some of the more negative aspects of America's racial politics were most pronounced. After the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, the Nixon Southern strategy is one in which they're trying to court disaffected white Southerners. And one of the ways that they do that is to push the racial politics that takes over, even as they are pushing this anti-national government rhetoric. So those two things have been fellow travelers in American political development. And I think that is one of the things that still typifies Republican rhetoric on policy. There's this idea that so many Americans have their hands out for government support. And part of what that argument is built on is a distrust of some people who have their hands out. The truth of the matter is, if you look at the range of American domestic policies, we all have our hand out. And Amy found this really great instance where that begins our Reagan chapter, where Reagan says, you know, the most dangerous words are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. And this is one of those famous Reagan anti-government sayings. But it was actually uttered in that particular instance at a time when Reagan was announcing that he was providing support to Midwestern farmers. So there has always been this sleight of hand when it came to the anti-government commitments of modern conservatives. They've been willing to use the government when it was okay for favored constituencies, and then to complain about the government and the uses of the state when the beneficiaries were people that they that were not part of their coalition and that some of them disapproved of.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, obviously those Midwestern farmers are mostly white. And then in the same press conference, he's asked, what about helping the city of Chicago, which is a city that's gaining a proportionally Black population and had their first Black mayor, Harold Washington. He's like, oh, no, they're on their own. If they, you know, we're going to cut all this support, but they have to raise it themselves. They shouldn't be dependent, which has a kind of, you know, air of, you know, welfare queenish kind of language about the entire city. I'd also add just that the racialized language, I think, just gets more extreme in the period that we're talking about. I mean, obviously, you get very, very overtly racist language earlier in American history, too. But like, you know, there's a book that came out, I don't know, maybe like 20 years ago, maybe more, Tolly Mendelberg's The Race Card. And like her, one of her big arguments then was that you can't, that people, you know, people can't use these really overtly racist kinds of images and language anymore. So they have to do it in these more subtle ways because they could turn off all of these more moderate voters. And, you know, but then, you know, in recent years, you see incredibly overt racist stuff from, you know, the Tea Party images of Obama as a, you know, African king or something with, you know, a bone through his nose. You get all kinds of incredibly overtly, you know, extreme racist kind of languages and images.
And in terms of race, you also note that it's used as a weapon that connects the sort of this embedded thread of distrust as a means of sort of moving citizens in particular political directions. But you also talk about the fact that polarization is a part of what's going on as well. And that kind of like with race, polarization is kind of working with this distrust and accentuating it. How is that? Is it the chicken or the egg?
Yeah, I don't think we try to like sort of pull those two things apart in the same way that some people, we're not really trying to tell exactly a causal story, but we are saying these things are happening. You know, the prime issue for us is the weaponization of distrust, the strategic uses of distrust. And so race is a part of that overall process, along with asymmetric polarization, along with, you know, distrust being something that can mobilize people instead of, you know, making them feel disempowered. So, you know, there are a number of different things that we tie into this whole broader pattern of distrust. But, you know, so I'm going to sort of step back and say, we're not saying one is like causal. It's more they're intersecting and interacting in various ways. And sometimes one gets more intense and then another one, you know, maybe not quite following, but we're not measuring it in that way either. Cause it's a, you know, where it isn't a, it's a very historically oriented study, you know, so we're not trying, and it's not a, we're not quantifying what is the level of strategic uses of distrust at any one time. We're describing it and we're demonstrating that it's going on with all the various kind of evidence that we have.
Doug, is there anything that you want to add to that?
I would say that if we go back to the prior era before Goldwater and even somewhat after Goldwater's candidacy, if you look at that era of bipartisanship in Congress and at least the willingness of various players to, at the end of the day, come together and hammer out compromise bills and legislation and policies for the United States, it's really hard to be on the side that says government always fails if you've just struck a deal with the Democratic leader or the Democratic speaker. I think the polarized era helps for the minority party, the party that's out of power at any particular time, to keep its hands clean and to say we didn't vote for that legislation. And then quite uniquely for the American political experiment, to hope that the government fails, to hope that the country fails, to hope that the investment in infrastructure or the investment in healthcare, to hope that it doesn't work. And I think that part of what polarization has yielded is this idea that no longer are the United States enemies, foreign threats, no longer are they the Nazi Germany or the Soviets, but now they will say, and we even quote one Republican office holder, the evil empire is now Washington, and that is that's a really dangerous thing, and it creates obviously. Given recent events, it creates a lot of instability for the legitimacy of the entire governing enterprise, and it's one of the things that it was disturbing about writing the book, because Amy and I had to live with this rhetoric and the trajectory of these dangerous tropes. Day in and day out as we were completing this.
And having read Jennifer Rubin's column today, which seems like it's a sort of précis of your book, she really is sort of digging into the radicalization of the rhetoric that is and sort of behavior in the Republican Party. That is sort of building on this question, this issue of distrust, and again, sort of who the quote enemy is. And you talk about that sort of in the afterword, because in the afterword, you get to the January 6th and you get to the way that that sort of COVID and the way that the government responded to COVID came into this sort of broader umbrella of distrust. Can you talk about why you needed to write the afterword?
Well, yeah, I mean, we were finishing up the manuscript altogether in the fall of 2020. And I kept saying, as we were leading up to these deadlines, well, we don't know how things are going to turn out. And really what I mostly meant was the election. We didn't know if Trump was going to win or not. And we wanted to therefore write some sort of afterword. At the same time that summer, we wrote something for a journal called Society on Trump's, sort of like, what do you expect to happen? There was a theme, like, what do you think is going to happen with this election or something that's going to happen? And what we said was, well, Trump has this long history of saying that, anytime he doesn't win an election, it was stolen. And we think that's going to happen here. So, we were kind of in a way, like, not sure what was going to happen except for that there was going to be this ramping up of some kind of rhetoric. I mean, obviously, if he won, he wouldn't do it quite as much, although he did. There was a, electoral fraud commission after 2016 that Trump got started and kind of failed to move forward. So when we saw what happened after the election and what happened on January 6th in particular, it was really clear that we wanted to, if at all possible, to include it, because it's, so much of a continuation of this pattern. It's part of it, but I would say really an intensification of it. Sort of as I was saying earlier, you have the normal skepticism, which is a very healthy part of being a democracy. And, you can set up institutional means to check power as we do in our Constitution, and we can change the relationship between the states and the national government as we have over our history and such, and what the federal government does and all of that. But then it became this weaponized distrust, and then really turns into this, very intense and frightening strain, dangerous strain of delegitimization. And so we wanted to include that. And of course, you know, and I mentioned before the sort of the inattention to governing and Doug as also that you see out of this this perspective, you know, that with the fight against COVID, the, you know, it really, you know, I mean, we know from lots of reporting that that Trump was not taking it seriously and really didn't even want any careful public health assessments to be presented to the general public because it would make him look bad. And I, in a way, that's something we haven't talked about before is the, you know, the part of the Trumpification of the Republican Party is putting himself as an individual, as coincident with the party as a whole. So if it's not good for Trump himself, then it's, you know, in his own thinking, then it's not a, you know, you don't want to pursue certain kinds of, you don't want to pursue certain kinds of policies. Not that they necessarily, it was an administration that had a lot of governing expertise or even believed in governing expertise. And I feel like I'm rambling, but I would say there is a part here that, you know, just the, you know, being against the administrative state or Steve Bannon saying that he wants to dismantle the administrative state. Well, without an administrative state, how do you accomplish governing? You know, if you go back to, you know, Max Weber, you know, over 100 years ago, you know, you need to have structures and systems in place in order to carry out state functions and to try to do it in as neutral a way possible with that, you know, relying on competent people rather than either charismatic leaders or, you know, people who are going to come in and just try to steal things who are corrupt. And when you have a political movement that's opposed to governing and wants to dismantle the administrative state, you're going to have a lot of messes that are not going to get cleaned up. And, you know, maybe that's even too soft a way to describe a pandemic that's killed hundreds of thousands of people. But, you know, that I think is an outcome of that tendency and trend in the Trump years.
And I'll just add that when you finish a book, there's a certain feeling of relief there. And as wonderful as it is to write a book with Amy Fried, you're just glad it's done. And I think we reopened things for the afterword of the book, in part because it was all there. We had predicted in the summer that Trump was going to discount the legitimacy of any election that he didn't win. We actually had a paragraph in that Society piece where we talked about how the Republican votes would be counted first, the Democrat votes would come later, and as a result, it's pretty clear that Trump will say in that instance that everything was being rigged as the vote count came in a differential way. And then when it came to COVID, you know, again, because I am naive about these things, I had hoped that perhaps some of this fever would break, some of this anti-government fever would break, because it would be obvious that this is a moment, this is one of those crisis moments where it's quite clear that you need the government, and you need the information, you need the expertise, you need the direction and coordination. And I think what we saw in the fall of 2020 and before November, and then in the months after November into January 6th, was the culmination of this strategy and the problems inherent in not believing in the government and not believing in the political process and not believing in the government that you lead as president of the United States, and not believing in the political process that you're participating in. So I think we opened it up to write that afterward because it was all there, and it was really the sort of distilled or crystallized version of everything we'd been warning about going back to Gingrich.
And I just wanted to ask one last sort of side question, I guess. Because you do talk about Trump in the last part of the book, obviously. And so Trump put himself forward as a candidate originally who could fix the problems. And in so doing, you know, kind of said, trust me, I can fix the problem. I alone can fix it, I think is what he said at his speech in 2016. And so that he positioned himself as the leader of a party that has been using this kind of distrust in government as a means of organizing and achieving electoral results. But then he comes in and basically says, I'm going to lead a party that distrusts government by saying, trust me. Does he do a sort of switch in terms of like, don't worry about the party, don't worry about the government, it's just all about me?
Yeah, absolutely. In certain ways, because on the one hand, he's warning about the deep state and everyone's going to be out to get him and all that sort of thing. And then he made lots of promises in 2016. It would be so easy to do healthcare reform. We can do this in a week, maybe less than a week. We're going to have infrastructure. We're going to, you know, do things on prescription drugs. And there were lots of specific things that he said he was going to do, even building the wall, which, you know, which of course was going to get funded by Mexico. So, you know, he was, part of it, that message, though, was that the other people haven't done these very easy things that he could easily do without any experience in government because they were all corrupt. Right. And that it somehow was going to be something that he could pull off very, very easily, because he has a good brain and he's a smart person, and he'd be able to do all of that. But, you know, of course, he couldn't, he didn't know how, and he got frustrated. I mean, you know, at least according to all kinds of reporting, there was probably an infrastructure deal that he could have gotten, but he wanted other things in terms of not, you know, really, enabling people to understand things that were going on in the administration and other ways. But I mean, I think that was part of his pitch. It was a distrust government, but I'm going to do things for you. But the really distrustful part was the other people haven't done this because they're all bad and they're all evil and they're all corrupt. And it takes the outsider of outsiders to come in and do this sort of thing. And so all government elites are bad. Anyone who knows, you know, how to make the trains run on time is, you know, or maybe did a decent job of it in the past, maybe not, but they didn't really have your interests at heart. And the other big switcheroo, of course, which would be something we haven't really talked about, the institutional part, is that you have the Republican Party, at least, maybe not to some extent Trump, but certainly the Republican Party saying, you know, they don't like a very strong president, criticizing Obama for that, going after, you know, czars and recess appointments and such, and then embracing Trump completely as a strong president.
Yeah, that's one of the things that we noted throughout the book, which was part of what convinces us that this is a strategy much more than an ideological commitment to be against government, is the fact that the Republicans are quite willing to embrace the Congress and its powers when they control Congress, and then to abandon and criticize Congress when they don't control Congress. Just as Amy indicated, they will embrace a strong presidency when the president is a Republican, is a conservative, but talk about the presidency being this sort of creeping dictatorship if it's Franklin Roosevelt or Barack Obama. And that kind of situational constitutionalism is just further evidence that that the rhetoric is the anti-government rhetoric is the strategy much more than it is revealing some sort of long-standing principle or commitment. And I think that Amy's absolutely right, and I was glad she mentioned healthcare. Trump would say as a candidate that we're going to do healthcare. or we're going to do infrastructure as if doing is just this very clear means end act that can be accomplished. But by the time candidate Trump is being sworn in and gives his inaugural speech, it's no longer about I alone can fix it. It's about American carnage. And that view of America falling back and America being fundamentally broken becomes part of the Trumpist rhetoric once he's in office.
And that seems to follow the course of the book in terms of the use of this rhetoric as an organizational end, as a policy sort of mechanism to, and again, as you talk about it, in terms of putting this political coalition together and sustaining it, the one thread that goes through it, and also managing that intra-party sort of fissures that sort of keep it all together. What happy news we have now? What is it that the two of you might be working on now?
Well, I'm talking with some folks about doing some work on New England politics, because there's really not that much that been studied as a region. But I certainly do also want to return to this project in some way and expand it in some way. We have a really, what I think, great chapter in chapter 7 at the end there, before the afterword, when we have to deal with the insurrection and such, where we lay out some ideas of ways to counter this, to focus on the same four things: the elections, the institutions, the organizations, and policy. And I haven't gotten deep to work on it, but I really am intrigued by trying to do some more work to write about that and maybe do some interviews with people who are involved in various projects relating to all of those.
Yeah, I would say that sadly, this strategy is not going away. I would love, as somebody who loves American national politics, for our book to become quickly irrelevant and a nice document of a bad era. But I do believe that we are going to continue to see this strategy unfold, and I'm sure that in one way or another, Amy and I will revisit it because we'll have to.
Well, I'm hoping that maybe there'll be a much more uplifting book that comes next. But unfortunately, I think I'm with the two of you in terms of understanding how this is also leading to the sort of perilousness of democracy in the United States, and the divisions that are being sowed in this weaponization of distrust. So I hope you'll come back and talk to me with another publication, be it uplifting or depressing. And I want to thank Amy Fried and Doug Harris for joining me today to talk about At War with Government, How Conservatives Weaponized Distrust from Goldwater to Trump, published by Columbia University Press in 2021. I assume one can purchase this at the Columbia University Press website. Is there perhaps a brick and mortar store with an online presence that you would like to give a shout out to?
Well, in my little town of Bangor, Maine, I don't know how many people, find their way there, maybe in the summer if they're going to Bar Harbor or going climbing in northern Maine, but the Briar Patch bookstore carries it. I know that. And I know Doug has had some sightings of it in some bookstores in his region.
I was happy to pull a copy off the shelf at the Baltimore Barnes & Noble, but I was also happened to be on the Harvard bookstore website today and noticed it there. So if you're in Cambridge, Mass., you can go find At War with Government there.
All right. So we will support independent booksellers here and there. And I appreciate you joining me today, Doug and Amy.
Well, thanks so much for having us, Lily.
My pleasure.